I actually do have sort of a bit of an agenda, which is that last week you asked about what gets reborn, and I gave a short answer. So I can sit there. So I gave the short answer, and the short answer was that the mind stream continues over time. And then I gave the caveat, which is that the problem with that answer is that what we think mind means is not what Buddhists think mind means. So it's not a very good answer. And when we talk about stream, then we're immediately thinking about time. And the way Buddhists think about time is not the way we think about time. So that creates another problem. And then as soon as we think about a mind stream or a mind, we think about my mind or my mind stream. So then we're thinking about I, and then things are really complicated, because what we think I means and what Buddhists think I means are really different. And if that weren't complicated enough, there are a lot of different opinions about these concepts in different schools of Buddhism. And Western scholars take the view that these schools had sort of historical development in certain ways, in the way, you know, Westerners analyze historical process. But the Buddhists themselves, after a number of centuries, kind of looked at all the different opinions that they had amongst themselves about what does mind mean? What does time mean? What does stream mean? What does I mean? What does mine mean? Mine, M-I-N-E, what does that mean? And they looked at all those different views within the different Buddhist traditions, because they all intermingled, kind of wandering around India or in the monasteries or whatnot. And they kind of looked at all that and they said, oh, actually, what we think is going on here is what looks like different ways of thinking about these concepts, which refer to this, these realities of mind, I, what have you, that these are sort of developmentally, you can developmentally organize them, that some are more subtle ways of thinking about these questions, and some are coarser ways of thinking about these questions. But some people who think about these questions are very realistic when they start thinking about these questions. They think that the world is material and that that's all there is, and then they kind of are starting to think newly or differently about these questions. And they start out as materialists. And some people are very psychologically oriented, and they start out thinking about these questions, and so they don't even think about these things in the same way as materialists think about them, because they're a little bit more subtle in their way of thinking about things, a little bit more sophisticated. So then there are different teachings in the Buddhist tradition for those people, because there are shortcomings to the way they think about things, and there are things they don't understand. And so the answers that come out of the tradition, or the answers that the Buddha would give to somebody like that, would be different than the answers he would give to somebody who's just a very coarse materialist. So I say coarse materialist, I don't mean that in a negative sense. I just mean that in a sense of like coarse versus subtle. That's what didn't sound right when I said that. And then some people are kind of idealistic. And idealistic means they tend to think that there isn't anything but their own minds, and everything they experience is just mental fabrication. Now that might be a stretch for us to think that anybody walks around and just that's the way they think about things, but there are people who think about things that way. Maybe not from birth or childhood, but they get to that place in their own philosophical reasoning. And so then the Buddha had ways of talking to them, saying, well, there are certain shortcomings to thinking about the world from the point of view of it's all just mind. I mean, we, you know, at the extreme we call that solipsism, which is, you know, like it's all just me, and anything is okay. I can do whatever I want because it's all me, that kind of thing. So within the Buddhist scholarly tradition, in the monastic tradition, then what ends up happening is the ancient scholars organized all these different ways of addressing questions in these complex hierarchies of this is the kind of answer that's appropriate for this kind of person who thinks about things in a certain way. Here's another kind of answer or philosophical system that's appropriate for another kind of person that thinks another kind of way. So it makes it actually fiendishly complicated to get a clear line on how to address some of these specifics. Be that as it may, since it's an important question, which is what gets reborn, we need to address it. And so the tradition which addresses that whole range of different possible answers, that tradition is usually called the wisdom tradition, because the understanding of how to think about mind, mind stream, and I, the tradition of understanding how to think about those things is called the wisdom tradition, because it's actually a new way of thinking. It's a different way of thinking about key, critical, essential things about being a human being. I mean, once you start asking the tough questions, this is where you get to. And you know, most people don't even want to ask the tough questions, and that's perfectly okay. As one of my teachers said, who actually was not a Buddhist teacher, he was a Swami in the Vedanta tradition, he said, you know, for a lot of folks, it's just you go to work and you come home and you have a couple beers, turn on the TV and go to bed and just do that day after day, and that's perfectly okay. And if that's the kind of life you lead, and that's okay, then that's fine. You don't need to hear anything about philosophy. That's perfectly okay. But if you're one of the unfortunate ones who started to think about things, then it's already too late. You know? And so then you have the problem of having to come up with answers. So that's everybody in this room, or you wouldn't be here, and everybody listening to this, or they wouldn't be listening to this. So now we have to come up with answers. So, but fortunately there are answers. But the thing about the answers is they're not just like, okay, here's the answer, answers. It's like, you know, it's not even like, why did the Roman Empire fall? And here are various kinds of interpretations, and here are the facts, and we come up with a hypothesis about why the Roman Empire fell. The answers in the wisdom tradition to these questions are, how do you get into a state of awareness which allows you to see the situation for what it actually is? And it's not just a matter of coming up with an answer that you can write down. I mean, you can do that, and that satisfies the mind, but then the mind asks more questions. Because no matter what the answer is, it's not going to be good enough for a whole variety of reasons. So the mind asks more questions. The Buddhist wisdom tradition basically says, we can do that, and that's probably a good thing to do because the mind wants an answer, and that's a good starting point for beginning the practice of looking directly at the situation so that you can actually finally get to the place of seeing what's truly there. But it's what some transpersonal psychologists in the 80s at least, and maybe still, called state-specific knowledge. The Buddhist wisdom tradition basically says the answer to the question is to get yourself into a new level of consciousness. Not so that you can think the answer to the question, because that's from this level of consciousness, but so you can see the truth of the matter directly. And then you know what the answer to the question is, which may not actually be an answer, you know, in the sense of like a logical answer, but to see the truth of things. It's a little bit like saying, if somebody were blind and they asked, what does orange look like? No matter what you did, you couldn't ever get the truth of what orange looks like to them. But if somehow they could have some kind of surgery or some medical treatment, and suddenly they could see again, then you could say, well, you asked me what orange is, there it is, all these walls, that's orange. Oh, that's what orange is, okay. Now I know because I'm in a place where I can see it. But no matter what you had to say about orange, a blind person would never get it. But once they ceased being blind, they would just see it. And that's not a rational answer. It's like, there it is. So it's like that kind of situation. In the books that we're reading, they talk, both in the Dalai Lama book and in Thubten Chodron's book, they talk about shamatha and vipassana as two types of meditation. Shamatha is calm abiding meditation. It's like when you get your mind focused and stable and peaceful. That's shamatha. Vipassana, which is also called insight meditation or special insight in the Dalai Lama book, is that state of mind. It's not, vipassana is, it's a way of meditating, it's a practice, but its outcome is a new state of mind. Oh, that's bad. A new state of awareness, a new state of consciousness, in which you see directly, it's actually called entering the path of seeing, you see directly what the truth of the situation is, what is it that gets reborn. So, to answer your question then, we have to get into this whole, you know, complicated, actually, it's not complicated, it's incredibly simple. The problem is our minds are complicated, and the way we think about things is complicated, and we've got to undo all those complications, which is why it appears complicated. When that stuff is undone, what comes out at the end is ridiculously simple. And you kind of ask yourself, when you experience some of it, you ask yourself, why was that so difficult? You know, why didn't I just get that right off? But of course, you know why you didn't get it right off, because there's this chatterbox and cultural heritage and all this stuff which created the problem. Vipassana, this is a Sanskrit term, vipassana, referring to insight or direct seeing of things, comes from the root V, and it's related to all the terms for wisdom, which have that root V, but most importantly for what we're talking about, what is called not understanding what's going on, misknowledge, something that's called ignorance, or wrong understanding. There are a lot of ways of translating this into English, none of which are satisfactory. Misunderstanding is a good one, is avidya. This is the Sanskrit for misunderstanding, which is the fundamental characteristic that we're all carrying around, which is the reason we're kind of even asking questions that don't have good answers. I mean, that sounds wrong. Asking questions that can't be answered on the basis, on the way in which they're asked. They have answers. The answer is what truly is. But we don't understand it. We don't see it. We don't know it. Because we're, the basic way in which we understand things is erroneous. And that basic erroneous way of understanding things in Sanskrit is called avidya. Sanskrit wasn't the language the Buddha spoke, but this is a very common term anyway. But Sanskrit, Buddhism. The use of Sanskrit in Buddhism came a few hundred years after the Buddha, but the language is good for the purpose. So avidya is wrong understanding, misunderstanding, and vipassana is right. But right understanding, but right understanding not like rational understanding, but like seeing it directly, correctly. Okay, so the whole, if you boil everything in Buddhism down to what is the practice about and what is the whole point of all of this stuff, it's minimizing the avidya on a moment by moment, day by day, year by year, in fact, lifetime by lifetime basis, and increasing the wisdom of seeing things for what it really is. And it is, it's a gradual process. Now, there's some schools of thought which say it can be, you can wake up just like that. But those tend to be like the Zen schools. But the Zen schools also say things like, oh, you know, you can be a great painter, just sort of, you know, slosh the brush around, everything's great. Well, it's because that's what the Zen masters do, but you know, the Zen masters practiced with a brush for 30 years before they started sloshing it around and great paintings came out. So you can have a sudden awakening in the Zen tradition, but you probably have it after sitting Zazen for 30 years and then something goes pop, so it's not just like, it doesn't just come out of no place. I mean, no Buddhist really believes that. In general, it's a gradual process. At the movie that we saw the other week, which was the Quantum Activist, thank you, the Quantum Activist, there's a point where the guy who's talking about this stuff, who's basically steeped in the Indian tradition of Vedanta. And Vedanta and Buddhism are incredibly interrelated, but we're not going to talk about that right now. But that's the reason why a lot of what he was talking about sounded very Buddhist, without his actually even knowing it for the most part. He talked about everybody's involved in doing. He said, but every once in a while you have to sit still and just be, and that's how you see what's going on. And if you want to make changes in your life, in your existence, you have to do it at a deep level, at the place of your being, not at the level of your doing. So he said, you just go back and forth. That what the life is about is going back and forth. He says, do, then be, then do, then be, do be. I thought that was very cool. But that's actually also very much in the Buddhist tradition, which is we have this life that we're given and that we need to live as best we can, but we do need to take time to set aside and just be and practice vipassana to get at what's really going on. And it's really possible to get in there and see it, but it's really hard then to carry that into the rest of your life, because what you see in that place is, I mean, to use my favorite metaphor, is very profound, and everything is very interconnected, and you have answers to a lot of these questions. Your mind is peaceful and stable, but boy, if you try to drive between here and Enterprise in that state of mind, you get a new life real fast, because you can't, you know. I mean, they say that Buddhas can be in both places at the same time, and the Tibetans actually define a Buddha as somebody who can be in the ordinary conventional place and in this deeply insightful place both at the same time, and see both things at the same time. Bob Thurman, who's a professor of Indian studies at Columbia, somebody that I knew from many years ago, used to say it was like a double exposure, you know, in the old cameras that had film, unlike the new digital cameras where you can't do this, the old cameras that had film, you take a picture, you forget to advance the film, you take another picture, you get a double exposure. He used to say that for the Buddhas, it's like they live in a world where they see a double exposure, because they actually see the conventional world that we see, which is the world of complete confusion, and at the same time they see what it actually is. And they see both at the same time, which is the interesting thing. It's not just like they're in this place where everything is like interconnected and beatific and everything's wonderful. They can be in that place, but if they're in that place, then they can't relate to any of us, because there's just, it's not like, then reality, okay. If you're in the place of conventional reality, ordinary existence, then reality is like soup that has a lot of chunks floating around in it. And when you're in the place of absolute reality, you're into blender soup. And there's no distinctions between anything. Everything is all merged together. So Buddhas can be in the place where both happens. But for the rest of us, we have to be in a place where the chunks are so we can relate to them. And sometimes it's nice to get into the blender soup, but we have to go back and forth. Because if we're only in the blender soup place, and if Buddhas were only in the blender soup place, they wouldn't be able to relate to us, because we're like the chunks. Does this make any sense? Okay. So the whole thing then, to go back to the point of this, the whole thing then is that we have these ways of not quite understanding the situation we're in, that's referred to as misunderstanding or avidya or ignorance or something like that. That's what creates all the problems. And that's where the questions come from. And what's needed is to get to a place where we've removed that as fully as possible, but it's a step-by-step process. And the way we do that is by sitting down and meditating and practicing shamatha and vipassana, calming the mind, focusing, and then analyzing the truth of things until we get to the place where we can actually see little glimpses of it when we're meditating. Then we go back to driving our car and having a beer and, you know, being ordinary folks, and get up the next morning and do it again. Sit down, you meditate, and you get in that place. Maybe you do it a couple times a day. And you just start going back and forth. And they actually do sort of bleed into each other. I mean, I'm making it like, you know, like the distinction, like they're really totally separate from each other. But they actually do bleed into each other. So I've been doing this now for, I don't know, 30 or 40 years, whatever it is. And I can sit down and I can meditate. And if I have a good meditation session, I can get into that place where there's a quality of wisdom. And I can sort of like not be utterly wrapped up in the vidya. It's not like it's gone, but I'm not like hopeless. I can see a few things. But, you know, I get up off the meditation cushion in the morning, come downstairs and start frying eggs and whatnot, and it's like I'm back into ordinary. But every once in a while, it looks a little different. Or maybe, you know, a lot of the time it looks a little bit different. It doesn't look the same as when you're meditating, but it looks a little bit different. And actually, the Tibetans have a way of talking about how to, when you've gotten into this enough, how to talk about, they have a way of talking about how do you think about the here, the ordinary, when you're not meditating, as a way of practicing. Even though you're not in the deep meditation state, they say that what you do is you think about this world that we're in as illusion-like. Now, that's real different than what Hindus say, that this is an illusion. They say it's illusion-like, and practice it being illusion-like, which is to say, you're walking around looking at things, and every once in a while, it's kind of like you knock yourself on the head and say, it isn't what it looks like. It really isn't what it looks like, what it is. I don't know exactly what it is, but I know this isn't it, because I've been someplace where I know it looks different. And that's sort of like the best you can do when you're driving the Enterprise. And maybe it's the best you want to do when you're driving the Enterprise is, it looks like this, but it's not really like this. It's really something else. So what is it that isn't really like, what is it that it isn't? What is it that it isn't? What is it we're seeing that's wrong? What is the essential point of what we're seeing that's wrong? And the thumbnail, easiest way to talk about that is that we see everything as disconnected. We see everything as independent or autonomous. We experience everything as separate. We don't experience things as vitally connected to each other or as a part of each other or flowing into each other or, you know, any of that kind of thing. You know? So that's one of the things that we see that is erroneous. In fact, sort of the thumbnail is that Buddhists, at least the Tibetan scholars, say that there are three characteristics of the way in which we experience reality on a moment-by-moment conventional basis that are erroneous. Three general categories of problem, if you will. Or you could say three general ways in which we cognize our experience that are filled with error. And the three errors, if you will, then, are that we see things as being autonomous or independent, rather than dependent and interconnected. So that's like an ecological awareness, if you will. Or if you think about the quantum activist movie, when you talk about things as being non-localized, we talk about reality as having a non-localized character. When you think about things as being localized, they're independent, they're autonomous. If you think about the non-localization of consciousness, then you're thinking about it's not one particular place, and everything is involved in it. So that's non-autonomy. And so Buddhists say, seeing autonomy is conventionally true, but it's an error. Seeing that the reality is not autonomous, that the things that you see are not autonomous, denying that, refuting that, that's wisdom. Okay? So things are not autonomous, but they appear autonomous. That's one thing. The other thing is that everything that we experience seems to be whole entity. It doesn't seem to be made up out of parts. It just seems to be there as a given. I mean, my favorite example is a chair. This is the one I use when I'm, you know, professoring. You look at a chair and there's a chair. Well, if you look at it and really think about it, you know, there's screws and wood and cushion and all that kind of stuff. It's made up of parts. But when you first look at it, think about it, you just get this sense of a whole thing because of its function and just the way in which you cut it out from the rest of the environment around it. But the truth of the matter is that it's made up out of parts. So, seeing things as being whole rather than made of parts is avidya. That's the error. Seeing things as being made of parts is wise. For chairs, that's maybe not a very relevant kind of an issue, but for bodies and minds and lives, then it becomes more relevant because we think of ourselves as a whole, but if you really get down to it, it ain't so, you know. And then that becomes a whole meditation practice, and there's a lot of meditations that Buddhists get into around this particular theme that look very strange to Westerners, you know, like meditating on skin, muscle, bone, blood, you know, all this kind of stuff. I mean, that is what our bodies are, but that's not what you see. You walk down the street and you see somebody and, you know, you don't see the truth. It's not the case that the whole doesn't exist. That would be another mistake. The whole exists in a certain way. It exists as an accumulation of parts. That's the actual way it exists. So to think it's just a thing with no parts is a mistake, but to think that there's no whole thing there at all would be an equal mistake. So another kind of avidya, another category of avidya, is thinking or experiencing things as wholes, but only as wholes, you know, wholes. One of my favorite Buddhist stories, and this goes back to within probably a few centuries of the Buddha, that to me is a classic for explaining this that I'll share with you, is there is this monk who's walking along and he's meditating, and it's actually kind of possible to do a walking meditation when you're deep into this shamatha, vipassana together. I mean, you know, and it's possible to not bump into trees and so on and so forth, but it's kind of like you just sort of are kind of stroking along slowly in a straight line kind of thing. And so you're very collected in that way. So there's this monk doing this, and there's this young Indian woman who has a big fight with her husband in a nearby village, and she's just, you know, totally pissed off at him, and so she puts on all her best clothes and makeup and everything else, or whatever Indian women did 2,000 years ago, and takes off to go to the neighbor's village to do God knows what. I don't know what you'd do in the neighbor's village back then. You know, maybe she got an old boyfriend or something. Anyhow, the story doesn't tell us what's going on. So she takes off, and she happens to walk past this monk, and she looks at this, you know, this old bald-headed guy is walking along, and she's all gussied up. And she just cracks up, thinking it's just completely ridiculous. And that momentarily pulls him out of what he's doing, and he looks at her, and she continues on, and he continues on. And, you know, 5 or 10 minutes later, whatever it is, the husband comes down the road, and in this story, you know, the husband is more respectful, and he says, "Venerable sir, did you happen to see my wife coming down this road? Because she might have taken another road." And the monk looks at him and says, "Well, I don't know. I mean, I was doing my meditation, and I heard this laughter, this woman's laughter, and I looked up from my meditation. But actually, what happened was, I saw her teeth. That's all I saw when I looked up from my meditation. I saw her teeth. And then I looked a little bit more closely, and I just saw this skin bag with bones in it. And I thought, oh, okay. And then I went back to my meditation. So I don't know if that was your wife or not." So, I mean, so now the, you know, I mean, that story gets interpreted by Buddhists in various kind of ways, like bodies are foul, be careful of women. I mean, you know, all kinds of sociological, you know, things that get packed onto this. So you have to be aware of those, because the essential thing about the story is, you know, he was in a deep state of meditation on wisdom, what's the truth of things, and he hears this laughter, and he gets distracted, and he looks. So when he looks up, he doesn't see a whole person anymore. He sees the actual physical reality of what's there, which is a bag of bones. So most people read that story and they say, oh man, those Buddhists are really sickos, you know. They hate women, they have all these weird meditations. But that's not what's going on at all. It's like he recognizes the whole and the parts together. And he no longer thinks attractive young woman because of that. He just sees what's there. Okay. So the two aspects of so far that we talked about of avidya, of misunderstanding or ignorance, are to see things as autonomous or independent when they're actually dependent or connected. As I said, that's like an ecological awareness of things. And it expands out into many different directions, and I'll come back to some of that because it gets at time, causation, all kinds of things like that. And the second is to see things as wholes when they're actually concatenations or compounds of parts that function as wholes. And the third thing is that when we cognize something, when we see something, when we hear something, when we grasp something, and we have this experience of that whole, which appears to be autonomous, the third thing that typically goes with that is we have a concept of identity in association with that. And it's kind of like, okay, there's a chair. I have the concept chair right next to this table. I have a concept table. Or there's Kayla. I have a concept person or wife or, you know, whatever happened to come to my mind. But there's that sense of identification. And we do. I mean, as children, you know, we grew up and we learn to identify everything. We name everything. But the thing is, that we never stop doing it is one thing. So there is no moment when our entire field of experience isn't full of things that have identities to us. I mean, that's how we relate to the world. That's how we go through life in the world. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that, except there's certain limitations to that. Here's an interesting one that I like. Democracy. Here's another one that I like. Freedom. Liberty. I mean, you know, it's not too interesting to say, oh yeah, okay, so I understand that I have this thing about table. And like, what's the identity of table? That's not a big deal. I can get it. But we're also driven by abstract concepts, and we think we know what it is and where it is and that it's alive and it's important. But we pretty much don't know what those things are because we have kind of transmitted or not ideas that drive us. You know, it's like America is the place that has liberty, has freedom, has democracy, you know, and you know, everybody else should have it because it's such a good thing. And well, what is it? I mean, you know, there are five of us in this room, and if you ask everybody to sit down and write down what does democracy mean, you get five different what does it means. Same with liberty. Okay, those are big things. How about success? How about love? How about peace of mind? How about enough? Okay, then it gets, you know, it starts getting really interesting. So I start with like the stuff where it's obvious. It's obvious that we have no idea what it means when we talk about democracy. We all mean something different. I mean, most of the people I talk to say, what does democracy mean? And they give me what I think is the definition of liberty. You know, liberty is you have certain freedoms to act in certain kinds of ways. And they say that's democracy. And I say, gee, I always thought democracy was a form of government where every individual has a vote in making decisions about how the larger whole is going to operate. So maybe I'm wrong, you know, but anyhow, point is that, you know, these big abstract concepts, it's obvious that we're not going to agree. But when you get down to other things, then it gets much more interesting. So the thing is that, again, from the Buddhist point of view, of course, everything then that we experience, everything we experience, these three things come together. So, and take the example of a 20-year-old college student sitting in a classroom. Whether they're a guy with women in the classroom or women with guys in the classroom, you know, what do they see when they're looking at each other? Well, they see wholes, for one thing, W-H-O-L-E-S. You know, they see whole beings. They don't actually see that, you know, there's this whole complicated thing that's come together that makes a person. They see people as being, you know, very independent. They don't see, you know, that if you go and talk to so-and-so, like Freud would say, you're not just talking to them, you're talking to their parents at the same time. I mean, they're completely wrapped up in that person. And in fact, what's even perhaps worse than that is everyone has such preconceptions and notions about each other that what's really happening when you're talking with another person, when a 20-year-old is talking to another person, they're really talking to themselves. Because there's this other person, but they projected all this stuff onto them, and who are they having the conversation with? And if that other person kind of acts up and refuses to accept that projection, well, I don't want to have anything to do with you, you know? It's like, you need to be what I want you to be if I'm going to have anything to do with you. And if you're not going to be that, I'm not going to have anything to do with you. So let's pull away from maybe trite examples. So the point is, though, that what makes this ordinary conventional reality illusion-like, which is the way the Buddhists say to think about not being in the meditative state, where you're practicing shamatha and vipassana, what makes this illusion-like, and this really does relate to your question, was Brian, what makes this illusion-like is that every given moment, in every experience we have of every single thing we experience, those three characteristics are operative. You see things as being autonomous, we see things as being whole, and we see things as having characteristics on their own, or on their own side, as the Tibetans say, rather than those characteristics being sort of projected or imputed on all of those things by us. And in fact, the reason that we see things as being whole rather than complex entities or compounds is because of the concept we have. That's actually what makes it, in this moment of time, a whole thing. And that's also what makes it autonomous, is that we have an idea about it, and that completely shapes the way in which we perceive things. So the fundamental problem, even of those three, the fundamental problem is this projective problem, or this designation problem, which is the technical term, or the seeing of identity someplace where identity really isn't. Identity comes from me, and it's as designated or projected onto things. And so the consequence of that is I misperceive those things. In the work that you do, Brian, you know, you see the natural world in a certain kind of a way that's informed by your own studies. I mean, you see this dynamic process that's going on. You see all the influences of what's happening in the forests, where things have come from, the historic impact of the people who've been around. You see complex systems where stuff that you wouldn't even expect to impact the forest is impacting the forest. I mean, my particular favorite is, you know, that there used to be a cycle in which the ocean ended up in the forest in the form of salmon that was dropped all over the forest by birds and other predators that would be eating the salmon after they spawn, they grab and they eat some of them. They'd crap, you know, salmon all over the place. They'd drop bits of salmon. And over, you know, eons, basically, the forest was receiving the nutrient of the ocean via this dynamic, complex process. Well, you can't see that in the moment, but you can know it based upon your study. So, avidya would be not seeing that, but wisdom would be seeing that, seeing that the forest exists in relationship to the ocean, that it's part of this whole larger system that's not apparent. And not only that, it exists in time, that it depends upon other factors, and that the mind that I bring to the experience of the forest can either be informed or not, or maybe it could be greedy. You know, you can look at the trees and you can see all these kinds of things. Somebody else can look at the trees and see, you know, timber harvest and money. And, you know, you're looking at the same tree, you see one thing, they see dollar signs. I mean, and it's not rocket science, we understand all of this. But this is the designation process, this is the projection process, this is avidya. And truth be told, in a certain way, what you see in the forest is as much avidya as what they see in the forest. Because you can't see the forest the way a wolf sees the forest. You see the forest the way an informed human being sees the forest. The wolf sees it differently. Now, a wolf has his own kind of avidya. It's a different kind of avidya. But it's not so influenced by the rational, cognitive, historic, scientific process. But then again, there's another side to this, which is because you've been able to educate yourself, and through your experience of being in the forest and what people have told you, you've gone from seeing things in a certain way to seeing things in a new way, a more informed way, ecological, interdependent, dynamic kind of way. So just as the rational mind and the sort of the inquiring scientific mind, or just as the mind in one state can be creating problems by not seeing things as they actually are, the mind can also be cultivated to begin to see things as they actually are rationally, and then to actually even go beyond that. Because you said there have been times when you've been hiking in the woods or maybe skiing or something like that, where you're just totally there. You're totally engaged in it. You're not even thinking about it. And there's like a dynamism and a dynamic, and it's a very different kind of experience. But I would guess that one of the reasons you can have that experience is that you could have perhaps had that experience when you were 6 or 8 before all this rational stuff started happening. But you can have this experience now or in your 40s or 50s, however you are, because you used your mind to undo the errors that your mind had even, in fact, created. Okay? Did that make sense? I mean, that's what education is. Well, in the Buddhist tradition, they have this notion, too, that you can use your mind, that rationally you can start on this process of recognizing what is avidya. You can rationally start understanding how it works. These are the characteristics of avidya. That's what we've been doing this evening. You know, looks autonomous? It's not. Looks like a whole? It's not. Looks like it bears its own identity? It doesn't. Okay. So this is rational. So you can start with a rational understanding, and then what Vipassana meditation is, and then this is dependent upon the shamatha, which is being able to focus your mind, that you develop that skill. Then what Vipassana meditation is, you get the mind focused on one of these themes, like, I'm sitting here meditating, and I'm going to look at anything, it doesn't matter what it is, and how do I experience it? Well, I experience it with these three characteristics. Well, I know it doesn't have those three characteristics, because let me look at it now. Yep, there's a chair, and it's made up of all this stuff. Oh, and by the way, looks like wood, but it used to be a tree. Used to be a tree. Well, actually, there are clouds, there's rain. I mean, all that stuff is in that chair. Okay, I can rationally understand that. So that's the first level of the Vipassana meditation, is seeing the mistake, then rationally seeing what's there, and hanging out with that, watching the mistake come up constantly and rectifying it with your own rational mind again and again and again and again for all of these different themes until you get to the place where you see the cloud in the wood in the chair. You see it. That's when things start to change. And that's when you start seeing directly what's really going on. And when that starts to happen, then the rational thematic stuff of analysis is gone. You don't need that anymore. Because you can literally see what the problem is and what the solution is all in the same moment in the same object, if this makes sense. So now to get back to the question of what gets reborn, you go through this process also in regards to I, mind, mind stream, time, body, all these things. And out of that comes the direct experience of what's really happening, which is where the answer is. So that's sort of the answer, but obviously in another way that's not the answer. So having said all of that, I'm not going to cheat and say, okay, dude, sit down and meditate, and in 30 years you're going to know the answer to this question. I mean, because just as it's possible to say, this is how the forest ecosystem works, and it's only a representation of what's going on, but it's still a representation, and you can do good things with a representation, like you can, you know, write grant proposals. And you can talk to legislators with that representation, and you can talk to cattlemen with it, and you can use it in certain practical ways, and it's actually useful and meaningful, even though it's not the literal truth. It's only a cognitive representation of the truth. So also in regard to the what gets reborn, there are things that can be said that are useful, even though, in the end, they're not actually what's going on, because they're only linguistic representations. So I'm guessing that we're 50 hours into this process, well, more than that. But I'll leave it at this point. And you know, we can come back to some more of this with Q&A, but we also want to do some meditation. It's actually 48 minutes. I talked too long. But it was a coherent whole thing that had to happen. So, yeah, this will go on for a few weeks, because now I'll come back, you know, the next time out to more about these specific elements of avidya and how to practice vipassana and what the wisdom tradition is and what goes on and all this kind of stuff. So I'll stop at this point.